Welcome to Creating Connection with me, your host, Dr. T, where we will navigate being human together. We'll do this through conversations, exploring the challenges and joys of life, uncovering insights and strategies to create meaningful connections, to foster personal growth and find solace in the collective wisdom of our diverse community. Drawing from a unique blend of academic expertise and personal experiences, I will dive into the joys and complexities of aging, death, dying, grief, and body image. With a blend of humor and compassion and understanding, we will forge connections that transcend geographical boundaries and unite us in our shared humanity. When we come together, the possibilities are endless. Creating Connection with me, Dr. T, starts now. Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Dr. T, and you're listening to Creating Connection on Transformation Talk Radio. Stay with me for the next hour as Dr. Wade and I dive into Zen and everyday moments. No self in a world of selfies. That's a quote we came up with many years ago. So I'm going to introduce you to Wade by reading his bio. So Dr. Wade Meggart has a PhD in depth psychology and a master's of social work. His career spans from teaching at UNLV, Baylor College of Medicine to leading mental health programs at DeBakey VA Medical Center in Houston. He's adept in therapeutic techniques like acceptance and commitment therapy, somatic experiencing, EMDR, and runs Dragonfly Psychotherapy PLLC, aiding the Houston LGBTQ community with mental health issues. In addition to his professional endeavors, Dr. Wade is deeply engaged with Zen Buddhism, integrating his spiritual practice with his therapeutic approach. His role as an educator extends to the Houston Zen Center, where he offers classes and facilitates a group for queer Buddhists, embodying a holistic approach to mental well-being through the fusion of Eastern philosophy and Western psychology. Wade, welcome. I'm so glad you are here. We have talked about doing this for a long time. We even had a podcast name. We were either going to be Dharma Doctors or Buddhas Like Us. And that was like in 2019, so 5 years ago.
It was that long ago?
Yeah. I was looking things up as I was getting ready for our time together. And we first met on the path, literally and figuratively, in February of 2017. So happy 7-year anniversary. I don't even know how it's been 7 years. Right?
Time just flies the older I get.
You know, my grandma used to say that. She'd say, Terry, don't wish your life away because it's going to go faster and faster as you get older. And every time that happens, I'm like, Grandma, you were right. You know, anytime I'd be like, oh, I can't wait for summer vacation or Christmas break or whatever. So, and here we are just clicking along 7 years later. So welcome, my Dharma doctor. my person on the path.
Yeah. It is kind of cool how we met, isn't it?
Right? Yeah. Do you want to say your version of it? Because I do think that's a funny story.
My version? Oh, gosh.
Well, we all have our own perception.
I don't remember if my version is the same as I told you 7 years ago. But
no one listening knows, including myself.
Okay. Well, it spawns out of your first question, which, no, you haven't asked yet. But, you know, when I was learning mindfulness as a therapeutic technique, maybe in a couple years before I met you, so like 2015, I started delving into mindfulness as a therapeutic technique that I would work with veterans, and I would use it in our teach it to veterans. And I just thought that I would see if I wanted to go further and get certified in mindfulness-based stress reduction. And so I took a training, it was a retreat training, right, in Petaluma, mm-hmm. California, and that's where you were. And I just remember, if I recall correctly, people were introducing themselves, and were they introducing other people as well? And this very bubbly woman decided to introduce you. And it just, it was kind of interesting the way she introduced you. I can't really describe it other than you looked a little terrified.
Yes.
Like she was going to divulge something that you didn't want her to tell anybody. But I just remember, I think she said that you had just started your PhD journey, and I think it was in social psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I need to meet her, because I was halfway done with my journey in psychology. And so I was like, I have to meet her. I don't know why. I just had to meet you. There was something about you. And on one of our breaks, you were literally on a path, like some grassy path that was kind of wet too. And I was walking down that path, and we were just about to pass each other, I think. And I said, mm-hmm. I have been meaning to meet you. And then the rest is history.
I know. It's so wild, because when I remember that moment, we were supposed to say something specific, and somehow this effervescent, wildly enthusiastic woman started talking about she wasn't answering the question. And I get very much like accuracy and let's be like, follow the question. And then my first thought was like I was mortified. I was like, I want to be a meditation teacher and I can't even get this one woman to answer correctly. Like, I don't know why I took it on, but I was so, so mortified. But the benefit of that was that we met, and we keep saying on the path. So for people listening, like often when you're talking about like mindfulness, meditation, Buddhism, it's like we meet on the path, or we'll see each other on the path, because we're on the path of, you know, knowledge, learning, enlightenment, whatever that is. But I love that we met on a literal path, and you are like a partner as we go through this. And the funny thing was, is that we met, and again, 7 years later, and, you know, texting, talking, sharing, getting on Zooms, because we never lived in the same state. We're now finally in the same time zone that I keep messing up. Sorry. I think I realized that's why I kept telling Wade, you know, to come on at 10 a.m. And he's like, can we do a time check? And I'm like, no, noon. But I was so used to adjusting for it. So we have, you know, talked about things that as we've been going along, and wanting to talk about these things as how they relate to everyday life. So you started to allude to, you know, how you got onto your mindfulness journey. So you started as a therapeutic practice, but what has continued on, or do you use it in your therapy, or has it been like a personal kind of metamorphosis for you too?
Both. I use it in almost every session every client, I should say. I teach it to almost every client. If it's appropriate, they seem like they would, I think everyone would benefit, but that's my bias. But I understand a lot of people aren't necessarily ready for it, or they have misperceptions about it, which we talk about. And then, you know, they still may not be ready just yet. So I just wait till they are. But yes, I think it's an essential tool, especially for people that want to get into trauma work.
Mm-hmm.
Because trauma work, the work itself, processing work of trauma, is very constellating. I'd rather mm-hmm. use that triggering, but constellating for people. It's very emotional, very exhausting, very scary. And, you know, they only see me for like 45 minutes. And to do some processing in 45 minutes and then just for me to kick them out the door and say, no, go live your life for the next week or two. I don't think it would be fair if I don't give them a foundation first of skills like they can use to ground themselves and to de-escalate themselves. So I do a lot of upfront, what we call resourcing, with mindfulness, as well as other exercises, somatic exercises, which are all very mindful.
Mm-hmm.
So we do a lot of groundwork in grounding people, giving them tools, right? that they can access when we finally get into trauma work and they leave my office and they need something to rely upon to keep them stable. So yes, I use it a lot in therapy. And then in my personal life, yes, I try to meditate every day. Don't always get there, but I meditate every day. If I'm not doing it formally, I'm almost always doing it informally. Yeah.
Could you talk about the distinction there?
Sure. So the formal is what most people might think of when they hear meditation, right? Is sitting on a cushion, olming out. You have your little mudra. That's formal practice. It doesn't always have to look like that. But yes, you're sitting on a cushion. You have a dedicated time that you're going to do this and practice. That's formal. Informal is, it's kind of like what people say when you take yoga off the mat. You take the meditation off the cushion and you're in everyday life. And I could be walking down a street and say, oh, where are my feet right now? Mm. How does the wind feel on my face? What's the temperature? How's that feel on my skin? That can happen anytime during the day.
Yeah. And then noticing, because I'm kind of smiling when you're like, oh, pay attention to the temperature. You live in Houston. And sometimes I get texts where it's like ungodly, so hot, so humid. And then I'm up here in the north and have some different experiences, not this year with winter, but So it's not only paying attention, because those things bring you in the present moment, right? Like, where are my feet? What am I feeling? What am I noticing? What am I hearing? That's like, you can never be in a previous sensation or in a future sensation. It's right here. But then what's fun for me, because I'm always all about like unpacking non-judgment, because then it's like there's almost an instant like awareness of like, oh, I'm here. Oh, it feels cold. And then a judgment and then a thought and an emotion. And sometimes it's like, oh, this will never end. You can get so caught up. So it's that practice of, yes, being present and then noticing what you're thinking about the present moment. And then next expert level is not judging the judging and just going like, oh, yeah, I have some thoughts about this.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's definitely another level is noticing. I like to call it thoughts as sensations.
Ooh, say more.
Well, just... that, we have the five senses, the five obvious senses, then, you have interoception and the sensations of your body, bodily system, digestion, et cetera. But then what I like to add, it's not technically a sensation, but thoughts are inevitable. Thoughts are uncontrollable. They just come and go like a sensation. Mm-hmm. So look at a thought as you get an itch that you have to scratch all of a sudden, right? You just sit with an itch and not scratch it. You can watch the whole wave of that itch, right? It'll come and it'll go. Same with thoughts. If a thought comes in, you just notice, oh, I'm having a thought, and you just watch it kind of come and go.
Yes, I haven't thought of it that way. I like that description because itches are wildly hard for me to sit with. I'm not a patient person to watch that arise and exist and like move on. I don't have a lot of zen or cool around that. It's more like, I have my back itches, get it. But I like that idea of just, kind of separating, because sometimes we get so caught up in like our thoughts are us, like our thoughts are who we are, our identity, our everything, but going like, oh, but is it, and like just having that pause and that space again, before you're just reacting to the thought and going like, oh, will this stay here, this sensation of anger or irritation, and to notice it. And it is simple, not easy. Like when you're in like maybe an interaction with like someone close to you in your life, maybe partner, someone, and then you have like a thought or an emotion, And it's hard not to go like, it's always this way, or it never is this way. And so we, you know, you can kind of start watching your mind go into the extremes from one end to the other, and then going like, well, what's the facts right now? Oh, the fact is, you know, whatever, whatever that is. They didn't load the dishwasher correctly. I love dishwasher meditation as an informal practice.
Oh, that I like that. Like, because I have, you know, I have a partner that will leave things out sometimes. So maybe I should add that as my informal practice. Clutter as my informal practice.
And what would that look like though? Let's play with that. What would clutter look like as a practice in the moment?
That's a really great question. So yeah, I would see a water bottle on the coffee table, and that, so as a practice, I guess informally, it would be noticing what the mind has to say about this image. Mm. Well, sensations are like the image itself, what I can see.
Okay.
You know, if I actually go, you know, I could, as part of my practice, if I'm going to clean it up or move it or whatever, my further sensations are just touching it and mm-hmm. carrying it and putting it away. But the thoughts in that scenario would be, you know, like watching how I immediately get irritated. those, I can sense that in my chest. You know, my chest gets tight. Probably my brow gets tight too. But then noticing the thoughts behind that irritation, which are, oh, another one. Here it is again.
Oh, you froze.
Can I ever get a day without this? Oh, sorry. Yeah. Can I ever get a day without this?
Right. Without the water bottle sitting out,
or without any clutter. Like, it's like, oh, and then, you know, and then it's all the other thoughts, like, oh, I'm the parent here. Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't ask to like take care of a child, and like all these thoughts about a water bottle,
right? And
those thoughts, if I let them fester, or if I should say, if I engage them and believe them and carry on with them, they could go with me for the next 2, 3, 5 minutes, you know, because if they're starting to stir, then, you know, what do they always do is they want to pick out confirmation bias. They want to pick out more things that keep them alive and stirring longer. Like, oh, there's another thing that he left out, or, oh, it's just, you know, and then if I hear him talking, you know, more thoughts about, oh, would you just shut up?
You have time to talk, but not time to pick up your water bottle.
Right?
Because it's like that story that we get so caught up in the, you know, I mean, for me, then I take it the next step, like, oh, they don't care about me because I have said this repeatedly and then it's not honored. When in reality, it's a water bottle. Like, it's like nothing, you know?
And it would be less than 30 seconds to put it in the refrigerator.
All the while going, I'm better than you.
I could put tape on, I belong here, and put it in the refrigerator.
Yeah. Put away by the best person in this house.
Put away by your dad.
No, those are fighting words, right? Uh-huh. You're like, yes, exactly. And I know what I'm doing with that. And so it's so powerful when we think about these things in our daily life on like where we get caught up and where we get sucked in. And my sister was when she first learned loving kindness meditation, which is a meditation that you know, first wish yourself well, and then you kind of increasingly out into the world wishing well and kind of noticing interconnection and all of those things. So she said at the time that she was doing a practice where if someone was frustrating her in traffic, she would say, you know, a loving kindness phrase to them. And she was like offering it to me as like a, oh, hey, here's a practice. And someone cut me off and we had just had this conversation and I couldn't think of any of the phrases, Wade. I was like, and all I just yelled was loving kindness. Like, that's as far as I could go, which then of course made me laugh. And then I was able to kind of pull back from that anger. But sometimes in these practices, all you can do is like at least acknowledge that you wanted to try.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, even acknowledging that the system is in its the hamster wheel is running, even acknowledging that doesn't mean it's going to stop.
Right. Right. And I think that's where people get frustrated when they first start learning about mindfulness and meditation is they're like, because I think people talk about it as like clearing your mind, calming your mind, emptying your mind, all of these things. And when they can't, because the hamster wheel is still going, even with the best of intentions or practice, instead, it's the mind doing what the mind does. And can you just observe what it's doing?
Yes. Yeah. And I think that it's almost always the number one response I get from clients is why they can't do it or why it doesn't work. Is because, oh, I can't clear my mind, or I can't quiet my mind, or I can't make it stop. And that's the biggest misconception, I think, about meditation or mindfulness, is that it's not about clearing your mind or quieting your mind, because, you know, the science shows us that we have about 90,000 thoughts a day. 95% of those are thoughts we've already had. And that they're not controllable, that your mind just regurgitates. That's what it does. It takes in information and spits out information. That's what it does constantly. That's what it's designed to do. So the goal is not to stop it, because you don't have power over that, right? Mm-hmm. Just recognizing that this is just a process. This is just a conditioned pattern of behavior. Well, if you want to call it behavior, it's happening in your mind, right? It's just a conditioned thought pattern that just, it's on a wheel, literally, and it's a loop, and it just comes around, comes around, comes around, comes around. And the goal is just to see that and then try to redirect the mind to what you can actually, you know, sense, touch, taste, hear, smell, taste.
Yeah.
I tell people that's the actual practice. It's like flexing a bicep, flexing a muscle, redirecting the mind back to your anchor point, whatever it is. Focusing on in the moment is the flex.
Yeah. I like that.
When you see that, it's like you're growing your mind muscle to be whole.
And to continue on to that, you don't just go do one bicep curl and go like, oh, I got muscles.
Right.
It's a practice. It's continuous. And that's what we're doing within our minds. And, you know, it's interesting what I noticed, like on my first retreat, what I noticed when I was actually able to like be still for that amount of time is that my mind would just talk about like the repeating. It's like either planning or judging, planning or judging. Like that was kind of my loop, and to then be still enough to go like, oh, that's kind of my default. That's where I go when I'm not engaged or trying to like numb or disengage. It's like, okay, this is what the mind is doing. And to say, oh, well, where is it going? And was it? I think it was Joseph Goldstein. I don't know. Dan Harris talks about it, but he says that the question that he'll ask himself is this useful? So like about at 50 times into my thought process of like, I need to go to the grocery store, I need to get gas, two things that kind of just have to happen and irritate me, you know, so I'll be like, oh yeah, I gotta get gas, I gotta go to the grocery store. And then pausing and saying, is this useful? Because obviously I've already acknowledged that these things have to happen, but to ask yourself over and over again, that question of, is this useful? I think is so helpful, because then you're immediately like, oh, it's not.
Yeah. No, I love that. I love that idea. Like, cause it isn't, especially in the moment, if you're purposely practicing mindfulness. Yeah. It's what is it? What is it? How is it serving you? Mm-hmm. Well, it's serving to keep you from practicing.
Oh, interesting.
right? It's because if you already have a resistance to practicing it, which many of us do, like even me after, you know, almost a decade now of practicing, when I sit down, every time I sit down, part of my mind is like, I don't want to be here. Practice. I don't want to do this hard work. I want to just think about planning or judging.
Yes, because you're actually building. I heard this description once, it doesn't matter. But it was talking about like a marble going down a sand hill. And so like the marble, it'll go down the same path over and over again. But when you try to get it to go down a new path, it'll like go down a little bit and then go back to the old path. And so, you know, you're constantly. And so if you're thinking about your mind that way and you're like, oh, I'm trying something new rather than getting frustrated, you know, for me picturing that like, oh, of course it's more comfortable to go to the tried and true, even if I have suffering, because a lot of suffering comes from the fear of the future or the rumination and regret of the past. And so if you start paying attention, you can say like, oh, am I adding to my suffering by doing this? And I'm trying something new. So I'll just keep trying to get that marble down a different path that's more helpful so that I have more ease or spaciousness in my day. Because that's my next question is, what do you notice when you practice, or what have you noticed in your own life when you're kind of able to tap into those practices?
What have I noticed about?
Just anything. Like, have you noticed, like, since you've started practicing almost a decade ago, can you see like a difference from what that practice has done for your life? Or
yeah. Totally. Well, I'm definitely less reactive. Like, it's pretty amazing. A lot of things just kind of don't hook me like they used to anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then they tell you this in MBSR, I believe, or in other mindfulness classes, right? Right, is if this is stimulus and this is your reaction, a mindfulness does this. Mm. It gives you a little bit more time and space to look at how you want to react or how you would normally react and say, do I want to do this? Do I want to go down that rabbit hole? Or like your question, you know, is this reaction helpful for me?
Yeah.
And that's what allows us to say, because the minute you're able to make a choice about it, it becomes a response.
Yeah. And then you might even notice that there's more choices, right? Like, because you can get into the habit of like, this is the only response or the only reaction that I can have. But when you pause and you're like, oh, well, maybe I could try this, or oh, maybe there's a, you know, some other way of approaching this kind of ruminating or cycling thought.
Yeah. And I find the best response has, for me, has typically been just wait a little bit longer. And usually what happens is it's no longer important.
Okay.
Because my mind has moved on to something else.
Something else very important.
Something else is all twisted about.
Yes. And it's so like, and I just can't stress this enough for anyone who's listening, is that, you know, this isn't a one and done, and these are practices. Like as you said, you know, sometimes I'll sit down to meditate and it is like chaos, you know, just like ping-ponging around and thought to thought and, you know, catastrophizing or whatever is happening. And to actually say, okay, this is what's happening right now. This is what's happening right now. Tara Brach uses a phrase, this too belongs. And so sometimes I play with that, like this too belongs, because we're human. We're here to experience the whole range of emotions, but we've decided that some are good and some are bad, and we don't want to do the bad ones. And so, you know, and that gets into that idea of like resisting, which you did a lot of work with people in recovery, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So is this phrase from, I always attribute it to recovery, but what you resist persists, is that?
I don't know the origins of that, but it is used a lot in recovery.
Okay.
I hear it a lot. Yes.
So again, that's like saying like, oh, and people who, you know, hey, play with this, like, don't listen to Wade and I. I mean, listen to us, please. but like, really, I would love for people to experiment with their own lives to say like, what happens when you say, oh, this is a thought, or you did a great example of like, where do you feel irritation in your body, and start getting curious about those present moment experiences and then just see what happens. You know, because I also have people who I've worked with who have said, well, I tried it and it didn't get better. And it's like, you know, because then that gets into this whole premise of, you know, I'm doing this to try to get to someplace or somewhere. And have you had people talk to you about that? And what do you say to them?
Right. Well, yeah, that's an expectation. And with expectation comes disappointment. It's connected. It's just can't have one without the other. But you remind me of, they say that in this practice, mindful self-compassion, which is another evidence-based training. And I hope I get this right, because I'm not as fluent in that. We don't practice compassion towards itself because we're, because we want to feel better, because we're feeling bad.
Oh, okay.
Right. So we practice this self-compassion, or which is being mindful and being like thoughtful to yourself, compassionate towards yourself, like just being loving and, you know, sitting with a difficult emotion or feeling is, and in a kind way, like you're not resisting it. You're just allowing yourself to feel it and saying, it's okay, feel it. It's okay. Like you're being like you would a child that's experienced negative. You just say, it's okay. It's okay. You can feel this. You're not doing that so you'll feel better. That's a goal that gets you out of the actual experience. Cause now you have, it's directed. Where mindfulness is not a direction. It's just a moment, right? So we're doing this to be compassionate towards how we feel, which is negative.
Yes. And I, yes, because what's coming up for me is when I'm feeling those things, whether it's like shame or God, I was, you know, not nice to someone or whatever judgment I have, and which would be the perfect self-compassion would be like, oh yes, this too, or, you know, this is hard. But those are the times where I feel the least worthy and lovable, you know, to, you know. And so like that, I think that practice can feel like a big sweep to go like, oh, you know, I'm going to be kind to you. That's why I keep a picture of myself as when I was little up in my office, because then I can like look to her and say like, oh, okay, what I say, what I'm saying internally to, you know, that innocent child that I was. And usually no. No, I'm kidding. Always no. Because you just can't, you know, you just don't look at that, you know, that expression or that version of yourself as like, you know, a piece of garbage. We don't have an image thing up here, but your picture of you when you were little is one of my favorite pictures, and I didn't have it, otherwise maybe I would have used it. But yeah, so to think, and so for people who are listening, you know, that is a great idea, is get a picture of yourself that makes you feel that kind of like tenderness, or like, oh, weren't they cute, wasn't I adorable, and then bring that to mind when you're trying to offer self-compassion, because it can be hard in the harsh reality of our adult brains of what should be doing and how we should be acting. It can be really hard then to do that pause and offer self-compassion.
Absolutely. I love that technique. And my therapist had me do a similar exercise where he had me find the most awkward or photo of myself that I didn't like as a kid and learn to love it. And through that process, I realized, why do I not like this picture? Because I remembered where I was when that was taken. and all the torture that I was going through in that moment. Yes. And that made me look at it in, no wonder I look like that. And no wonder I don't like this picture, because I was suffering and no one was helping me.
That is next freaking level, dude. Like, that is like, as you're, and I have pictures that I will even to this day go, oh, you know, and want to just like brush aside.
Remember what you're going through. You were suffering. That's why the picture came out so awful.
I hate this, because now I have to try this practice. It seems so powerful, and woof, I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, thank you. I hadn't heard that one. That's next level. So for anyone who's trying, you might start with like a sweet picture. Yes. And then work your way up to the most awkward picture of yourself, and see what you can offer yourself. Or even if you can't offer, let's say this, even if you can't offer self-compassion to yourself right in that moment, you can just notice the thoughts that come up. So like, going back to that experience that we were talking about earlier, is just like, okay, I'm looking at this picture. Maybe it's not possible immediately to go to that like awareness and tenderness of like everything that you were going through in that moment, but you could just, I mean, or even like my driving example, just go, this is a picture of me. That's the fact. Like, and just maybe even that gives you that little bit of space to then, you know, working with it some more, to seeing the judgments, to then expand out. And I think maybe
Yeah. Or like you said, you know, just sitting with the emotions that come up as from looking at it, and how they produce in your body, the sensations of those emotions, like,
yes,
the or judgment, or like, notice how that hits your body, you know.
Yeah.
Often a little, you know, a pit in the stomach, or a slump in the shoulders, or, you know, notice how you maybe have this urge to look away. Like, just notice how it all lands. You don't have to practice, oh, who was I in that moment? Just, what's so difficult? Let me sit with this difficult experience as I look at this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you are a writer or a journaler, I've actually had, you know, a picture up, and I've written a letter to my little self, and just like stream of consciousness, you know, not like I'm trying to give advice. I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm literally just like, what would I have maybe wanted to hear at that time? What would I have, you know, what do I think now when I look back at those things? And just, you know, not censoring, but, you know, kind of the practices to what I like to do is set a timer and then just write without stopping, you know, and just see what comes up.
It's called a time traveler letter.
Oh, is it? I didn't know it had a name.
Yeah, like if you went back in time and you could talk to yourself in that moment, what would you say? Or if you were that young kid, what would you want your older self to say?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you ever, I used to have my gerontology students write a letter to their future self. Have you ever done that?
That's interesting.
Oh, some of them, I mean, just tears. I mean, some phoned it in, of course, they're undergrads, you know, but some people really took this to heart, and I would cry grading them, because they were so beautiful. Right? I know. What would you say? Something to think about. I love these practices. What I wanted to get into, so you've gone from, you know, kind of learning about MBSR or mindfulness-based stress reduction as a way to like help your therapy patients, and then you've kind of grown into this, and your path has led you to Zen Buddhism. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me a little bit about that, or how that's different, or what drew you to it in the first place?
Sure. Yeah. You know, it was, from doing all the, I'll call it secular mindfulness practices, I guess you could say that for me, I mean, it was great. It worked. I loved it. At the same time, something felt like I was missing something. So I just, something just kind of pulled at me. So I just wanted to go further, see, well, what are the origins of mindfulness? You know, where does this come from? And, you know, knowing that Jon Kabat-Zinn took it out of Buddhism, I was like, okay, well, let me check out Buddhism. Mm-hmm. So I just started listening to different podcasts, reading some books, and it just really made a lot of sense to me. Just some of the principles and the foundations about Buddhism and suffering, and, you know, mindfulness is a basic, the foundation of Buddhism, because it's a way to alleviate suffering. And that's the principle of Buddhism, is that everyone suffers. And that the way to alleviate it is through mindfulness, which is true. It's proven scientifically, and it's true. So what I love about that is some of the principles I learned about or read were very in line with Western psychology, like a lot, very similar. And that just made a lot of sense to me, because I'm a depth psychologist. I'm a social worker. I practice therapy, and all the foundations or techniques in Buddhism for alleviating suffering and living a wholesome life are just in line with psychology. That's what kind of really got me interested in Buddhism. And I wasn't really assigned to any particular sect of Buddhism. Like I didn't know about all of them, first of all, but I had moved from Las Vegas to Houston for work. And by this point, I had already learned about what a Sangha is, which is a community of fellow practitioners. And I learned about how a Sangha helps your mindfulness practice and helps you see more of your stuff through interaction with other people that are practicing the same. Like when you go on silent retreats together, it really helps you see when you're interacting silently with your community, what comes up. Right? And it's that being with other people like that really helps you see your stuff. And so I just went, when I got to Houston, I was like, I want to find a Sangha. It didn't matter who,
right,
or which version of Buddhism it was. And in Houston, there's quite a few different temples. And actually the very first one on my list was the Zen Center, simply because it was the closest to my house, for one, and they had an LGBT group. So I was like, oh, I'm sure I could find something here that might interest me. And after I went the first time, I never left, because it was just, you know, I just threw my list of other temples away, because it just, I felt like I found my home.
Yeah. But the Zen practices, because I was able to go with you to the Houston Zen Center, which is in this absolutely beautiful renovated house. It's on a gorgeous boulevard. I mean, what a great place to practice. And the people were very welcoming and friendly. But there's certain things that you have to do.
Choice.
Yeah, rituals. Thank you. And as a, you know, as a recovering Catholic, or however I want to say that, I was like, well, what are these rules? And I'm going to get it wrong. And so then going back to the beginning of our conversation of like, I want to do things correctly. You know, I was out of my element, but there was also these things where you'd stand up and bow. And I called them Buddha burpees.
I know. I love that.
And I'm like, well, how many are these, are we going to do? But there's some intentionality behind, you know, you can talk a little bit more, but I know you've talked about like how you do dishes at retreat. I don't know, turning, I'm doing a motion with my hands. Okay. Yes. But there's, and sewing your thing. I don't know what it's called. Please share about these seemingly simple like rituals or acts, but what does that do when you're practicing that in that way?
Great question. I'll see if I can do it justice. And I was the same as you when I first went. Like, the one thing, although I loved the people are amazing, that's really what is I did have a difficult time with the genuflecting. It wasn't genuflecting, you know, the Buddha burpees. Same as you, recovering Catholic. And I'm like, this, I hate this stuff. You know, what am I'm bowing to this? What am I bowing to? You know, what am I bowing for? Why am I doing this? And there's so many of those rituals when you get in the temple, like you bow here, you bow there during certain services, you do this, that, you chant this way, you do this way, you know, turn around, put your left foot in, take your right foot out. And all of it was super annoying. And because I'm like you, like, I want to do it right. I want to be perfect. But, you know, over time, I started to realize, and I don't know, I'm sure there's, you know, because it came out of Japan, I'm sure there's a lot of more reverence and more meaning behind the rituals. And I don't want to discount that, and I don't want to play it down. But for me, what mattered most was that I realized that, oh, these are all just designed to keep me present. Because, and like, right. So if I forget to bow somewhere, it's also designed to watch what your mind does when you realize you've messed up.
Oh yeah.
Right? Cause here comes the self-judgment. Oh, you can't get this right. You keep forgetting. What's wrong with you? Like, it's all designed to help you see your own mind. It's not designed so people can critique you and judge you. But that's what you think people are doing when you mess up. You think, oh, all these people are seeing me get this wrong and they're laughing at me.
And if they are, that's their practice.
Right.
but they're probably not.
Probably not. You know, they're all thinking the same thing. Like, I'm trying to, where am I supposed to bow?
Yeah. So it's almost a checks and balances to get you into the present moment. You know, these moments of time, because we don't have that a lot in our lives, right? Like, we don't, you know, kind of autopilot when you drive somewhere familiar, you know, you might, you know, have conversations that feel like Groundhog's Day and all of those things that, you know, but it's like, oh, okay, I wasn't being present. Now I'm judging that, or I'm being present and I feel, what's that? Prideful because I did it right. You know, cause there's that too. Like, look at me. I am such a good sitter stiller.
Yes, that too. Yeah. It's designed to, yeah, watch what your mind does when you get it all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so amazing. I'm better than everybody else. You all can't touch this.
Yes. That's where I always love to bring like a sense of humor at my own whatever's going on, right? You know, like, okay, yeah, here this is again. And, you know, aren't I, you know, all that and a bag of chips. Do we still say that? We don't.
I don't know what they say these days.
I don't know either. It's fine. Get on the TikTok, you'll find it. but no, I think the important thing is that, you know, as people are either entering or in their practice, to just, you know, what can you bring, like, with curiosity, maybe a sense of humor, some kindness and compassion. You mentioned big ones, because and notice when you're not able to, because that all of life is the practice. But I like what you're saying about like Zen Buddhism, that, you know, it's giving kind of like in the moment real like opportunities to see your stuff. What do you have with your judgment? What do you have with your judgment for self or others? I know being on retreat, you and I had the opportunity to be on retreat together at Spirit Rock, and noticing like when we'd pass silently, and that, I think that was the only time that I've ever, well, it doesn't matter, but like in that situation of like knowing someone, oh my gosh. And you're supposed to have like the, what do they call that with your eyes?
Modesty of gaze.
Yeah, modesty of gaze. So you're not making eye contact because we can express so much with our eyes. And like passing you, I'm just like, oh my God, I just want to talk to Wade. And, you know, it was like so interesting to not know what your experience was and then to connect at the end. And then, you know, the work that you have to do at Spirit Work, not have to, but the practice of, you know, doing a job each day when you're on a longer retreat, that gives the opportunity to be like, oh, you know, notice your judgment about your fellow retreatants, or like, I'm doing it the best, or I'm on time, or I'm late, whatever. It's all of life, man.
I don't like this job, or
yes,
right? Yes. It's all, yeah, it's all designed, well, not necessarily, you, it is designed to help keep the temple going, but also to watch your mind. It's all designed to be in the moment and watch your mind, right?
Yes.
Watch what your mind does. And like, so in Zen, it's work practice, actually every practice, like you mentioned when we sew, like you said, I love how you said simple, because really for Zen, that's their, one of their big things is when you do one practice, you do one practice completely.
Mm. Meaning
simple. Sweeping is simple. You just sweep. That's all you do. You just sweep. And if you're that moment completely, completely, there's no, it, none of that bothers you, because you're not paying, the mind is what has commentary about what you're doing.
Yes. But
if you're just totally paying attention, it's like being in the zone. If you're totally in the zone with sweeping, it's over and done with, and you're like, didn't even know what happened. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yes. Because it wasn't all of that added suffering, which then gets that the body involved and the mind involved and the looking for evidence of why, you know, everyone else sucks or whatever it is. You know, but sweeping is just sweeping, and putting a water bottle is away is putting a water bottle away. And this is bringing it back. No, but I do, I think that that's, I mean, that's what I love about mindfulness practice, is that it is everywhere and in every moment. It's not one and done. Our minds are wonderful, and they're designed, and they're beautiful. And also they can cause a lot of havoc, you know, when you're not in the moment. And so that, yeah. I don't know. I guess that's what I would say to people is, I usually like to give people action items, you know, like to, you know, to try out. So I think, and I hadn't planned any, but organically out of this conversation with you, I would like people, if you wanted to find a picture of yourself, either a, you know, sweet one or a more challenging one or both, and sit with them and just see what arises. You could try doing that time travel letter. You could write a letter to your future self, but any of these things where you're bringing yourself into your own compassionate care and kind of understanding. And I think when we, because I mean, I can give so much compassion to everyone else, or so much grace, or so much latitude of like, oh, of course, well, of course you were really tired, or of course, and no worries, you know, but I'm like, forget a meeting and I'm like, or not forget, but I'm late, you know, then I'm not human. I hold myself to this weird standard. So for people who want to play along, you know, start working with and noticing where your mind gets kind of in those habit loops, and seeing if you can either interrupt with the question of, is this useful, or just noticing what's happening in your body and just see what happens. Like, you know, again, you know, you know, we've found it to be a practice, and that's supportive, but not everyone wants to try it right away, but they can dip their toe in. Dip. No.
I'm sure they do that too.
Sure they do. And we didn't even get to talk about your class, because you've done a really cool thing bringing two of your loves, Zen and ACT, and I'm forgetting, acceptance
and commitment therapy.
Yeah, bringing those two together. So I would love to have you back at some point so you could talk a little bit more about that, because I think that's super powerful. But I loved this conversation. I love that we're on the path together, my friend.
Me too. This has been wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Yay. So I'm going to wrap it up with a reminder that you all can join me every week for a free live guided meditation on Zoom on Mondays at 1 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Central, or 10 a.m. Pacific, and it's all of it. But you can go to my website, ccwithdrt.com. That's ccwithdrt.com to reserve your spot. And I do want to say thank you all for tuning in to Creating Connection. I am grateful you chose to spend this time with me today, and thank you, Wade, for being here. Please reach out with any questions or comments, show ideas. It helps me if you share the show, and you can join me on the first and third Wednesdays of every month at 1 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Central, and 10 a.m. Pacific. And until then, take good care of yourself and others. See you back here next time. Bye. Thank you for listening to Creating Connection with me, Dr. T. You can join me by tuning in on the first and third Wednesdays every month at 10 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com, where we will navigate being human together. Being human means that we all have a body, and we will all experience loss, grief, and aging if we're lucky. Let's join together on this journey of exploration, support, and mutual learning. I love bringing people together, and on Creating Connection, we are a conversation away from understanding another person and, quite frankly, ourselves. For more information, visit ccwithdrt.com.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.